Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. Well, this week we have a fascinating conversation between Grammy-winning jazz violinist Zach Brock and Equinox Jazz Festival organizers Chester Grundy and Richard Young. We have an interview with the next artist Green Room Exchange will be bringing to town, and the results of a study of drinking water quality across the state. First, our children and their schooling. Lisa McKinney is Director of Communications at the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, a nonprofit, nonpartisan education policy organization in Lexington, where they're keeping watch on the mixed signals and confusion around federal funding for education. And Lisa's joining us to sort through some of the more immediate concerns around how actions being taken in Washington are having real effects on Kentucky schools and students. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And so let's look at those immediate concerns. What's happening that keeps you up at night right now?
Sure. So there's certainly concern around education cuts at the federal level to the budget, like those put forth in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, for example. And we're certainly watching what Congress does around education-related budget funding. However, I would say an even more immediate concern for me is the potential for Congress to put forth a rescission vote and claw back some of the federal money that has previously been allocated to schools across Kentucky and that they are currently kind of relying on for programs that are already in place. And so this concern kind of comes from two places. One is observing what Congress has already done. So earlier this year, they called a rescission vote and clawed back federal money that has been budgeted to various organizations across the U.S. and across Kentucky. And the Office of Management and Budget has indicated that another rescission vote is possible in September when Congress returns from recess. And this one would be targeted at schools. So, like I said, a rescission vote is a little bit different than budgeting because it claws back money that has already been allocated. And what that means is that it can cut grants off midstream. And this keeps me up at night because there's a lot of programs going on in schools right now that are seeing really positive results and that are, in many cases, halfway through or most of the way through their grant period. And they're at the point now where they're seeing what works and what doesn't work and trying to scale what works. And if a rescission vote goes through and that money is clawed back, those programs are kind of be cut off at the legs and they won't be able to go forward with that progress anymore.
In the introduction, I mentioned mixed signals and confusion around federal funding for education, which is what you've been describing. The Kentucky Department of Education reported that roughly $87 million across five grant streams in the ESSA, or Every Student Succeeds Act, had been frozen in Washington. And these include migrant education, professional development, English learner support, student support, academic enrichment, and after-school programs. And on top of that, about $9 million in adult literacy funding was withheld. And I'm not sure everybody knows about the full extent of the drama that went on behind the scenes to get those funds released. What can you tell us about that?
There were actually two lawsuits filed that challenged this freeze. There was a multi-state lawsuit that was filed in federal court in Rhode Island, and that was led by New York, and notably Kentucky did join in that litigation. And then there was a separate case brought by nonprofit organizations in D.C., and they were arguing that this pause violated the Impoundment Control Act of 1974. So in March, a U.S. district judge actually granted a preliminary injunction requiring the federal government to release those frozen funds. However, the freeze had already occurred, and it delayed a lot of programs, including after-school programs, extended learning programs, teacher training, early childhood programs, many programs that were already in place. So following the court order, the U.S. Department of Ed has begun releasing the funds, but this episode really just kind of underscores the importance of congressional oversight to kind of prevent these disruptions in the future. Also, there needs to be some congressional oversight in ensuring that these funds are fully released and released in a timely manner.
Just to put a point on it, many of these programs, if not all of them, were actually underway. Did all or some of them have to just stop dead in their tracks?
Yes, depending on the details of the program. And they certainly had to stop planning, which is very difficult when you don't know what your budget is going to be. It's very difficult to plan for the future. So avoiding these kind of disruptions in the future is really important to keep schools running smoothly.
Well, I think at this point in our conversation, it might be good to just explain what taxpayers get in return for the investment of their tax dollars in education. What is the ROI, the return on investment?
Sure. So I actually really love this question because I think public education, when invested in wisely, is kind of the poster child for a positive return on investment for public dollars. And so, of course, we're talking about taxpayer dollars here, but when I talk about ROI, I also mean like investment of time, energy, expertise that community members and families and educators put into supporting their local school systems. Those all have a really positive return on investment. But in terms of taxpayer dollars, there are certainly economic returns in terms of a stronger workforce, a better prepared pool of workers, which of course attracts businesses and investments to communities. Access to a high quality education reduces reliance on public assistance. So, of course, that saves the government money. And then when we're talking about post-secondary education and access to that in particular, college graduates pay much more money over their lifetime in taxes. So there's an increase in tax revenue for governments. And then there's also social benefits. People who have access to high-quality education live healthier lives. They are more civically engaged. There's lower crime rates. And again, when we're talking about the financial side of that, that reduces the state's need to invest in things like prison and healthcare. I would also say schools, particularly in the rural and smaller town areas of Kentucky, they're really like civic centers for a lot of these places. This is where kids learn to be civically involved, but it's also where a lot of public meetings happen. They're kind of community centers. So there's a lot of social benefits to investing in schools too. And then lastly, I'll say access to high quality education is really the number one way to break generational poverty. And of course, that pays dividends for generations to come for individuals and for the state.
We're a few years into what's known as the Full Service Community School Grant, which is credited for making some important differences in school districts across Kentucky. Is that grant now threatened?
Yes. So that grant could potentially be clawed back through a rescission vote, as we kind of referenced earlier. So the Pritchard Committee does administer the first full service community schools grant. And currently we're operating in 40 schools across 20 districts in Kentucky. And the goal of the initiative is to create a statewide sustainable system that integrates wraparound supports and family engagement to address both academic and non-academic barriers to learning. So non-academic barriers to learning, of course, are things like access to transportation, food insecurity, health issues, things that get in the way of kids learning and in many cases get in the way of kids even being present in school. So in order to do things like raise our reading scores and raise our math scores, we need to kind of address these underlying issues first. And we need to address them in ways that don't place even a larger burden on our public school teachers who already have a lot on their plates. So the idea behind these initiatives and these community schools, as we call them, is to address these non-academic barriers to learning as well as academic barriers to learning and leave teachers to do what they do best, which is teach and take care of the academic side.
Kentucky voters have rejected Amendment 2. It would have created an opportunity for state legislators to change the state constitution in a way that would allow private school vouchers, redirecting public money to private schools. And the Trump administration's budget proposal would provide a way around this by creating a dollar-for-dollar federal tax credit for donations to organizations, such as private schools, that grant scholarships, which could then be used for private or religious school tuition. And it would allow the states to opt in. Could Kentucky opt in, even though Voters here have voted against Amendment 2 and said no to public funding of private schools?
Yes, they could, because this is sort of a different mechanism to do it, and it's federal dollars rather than state dollars. So they potentially could opt in. Clearly, you know, as you mentioned, Kentucky voters are not aligned with diverting public funds to private schools, as they showed in the Amendment 2 vote in November. I believe it was defeated 65-35, which is a pretty wide margin. You don't get people to agree on anything quite that much. But the voucher program in the OBBA could override the state decision, and it could incentivize donors to support private school scholarships using federal tax credits. At the Pritchard Committee, we did not support Amendment 2 for a variety of reasons, but primarily the data shows that these types of voucher programs cost a lot of money, and they typically only benefit the highest income earners. Most of the time, these scholarships are not enough to make the difference for families who cannot afford to send their kids to private schools. So what they end up doing is being just a little bit of a break for folks who can already afford and are already sending their kids to these schools, which is great, but just not what we should be spending public dollars on.
In the introduction, Lisa, I mentioned that the Pritchard Committee is nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from Bridget Blom, who hosts an education series on Eastern Standard, that you're very serious about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, what is the Pritchard Committee's message to Congress right now?
Our main message to Congress is just simply, let's keep doing what works. Communities were promised these funds when we're talking about the education-related grants, and they've spent years planning and implementing these programs. And it would really be a shame to not allow them to finish them out and make the most of the money that's already been spent. So our main message to Congress is just, let's protect the programs that are delivering real results. And now that we know what's working and what's not working, we can scale those programs. And we're really in the best part of it. We've set up the infrastructure. We've set up the staffing. We've set up the programs. We've gotten data back about, like I said, what's working and what's not working. And this is the good part. This is where we take what's working and we scale it and we benefit even more students. So if some of this money is rescinded, we'll kind of be cut off at the legs a little bit there. So our main message is, just keep those promises to the communities that were made, and let's keep doing what we know works.
All right. That's Lisa McKinney, Director of Communications at the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Tom.
If you were to sample and examine watersheds across the state and what's in our water, would you be happy with what you found? Water is a life essential for each and every one of us, so to get an answer to this important question, we turn to Dr. Tiffany Messer, Associate Professor of Biosystems Engineering at the University of Kentucky. Earlier this year, Dr. Messer and her team published an in-depth look at what's flowing through Kentucky's streams and rivers, and so she's here to tell us what she found. Thanks for joining us, Tiffany.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So what did you set out to learn? What was the goal of this study?
We wanted to see what was in our surface waters in Kentucky. And the reason that we particularly were interested in this was because over 95% of Kentucky drinking water comes from either a reservoir or a lake or a stream. And so we were really interested particularly in surface water in the state, just because that's where our drinking water is coming from.
Can you explain for us in layman's terms how you went about this research?
Sure. So we install what we call monitoring stations. Just imagine them as a place where you will put some sensors in to look at different water chemistries. And what we were mainly looking at was things such as your pH of your water or your temperature. And then we would go out monthly over a 6-month period, primarily in the growing season, to look at what those data collections from these sensors were telling us, and also collect water quality samples. And what we were doing with the water quality samples, we were actually looking at 77 different chemicals, and we had 4 different locations. So one of the things of interest is, how does land use and location in Kentucky impact our water quality in our streams? So we had one site that was in a more central Kentucky urban area. We had another site that was in western Kentucky in a predominantly agricultural area. We had another site that was in eastern Kentucky in a primarily mining region. And then lastly, we had another Eastern Kentucky site that was in an area we knew there were a lot of straight pipes, so water going directly from homes into the stream.
Well, here's the big question. What did you find?
Great question. The good news, I would say, is that we didn't see a lot of major concerns based on what EPA regulatory requirements are for drinking water. Majority of the things that we were finding definitely varied by location, season, and also flooding in the landscape. So we actually, unfortunately, were sampling during the massive flood that we had in eastern Kentucky a few years ago. And so we were able to also look at how that could impact our water quality in our streams. Majority of the chemicals were on average below current human standards, but we did have five that exceeded the water quality criteria for freshwater organisms. Think more of like bugs in your stream, which overall impacts the overall health of your stream. And these included aluminum, iron, and these two are particularly in the ag watersheds and the urban watersheds. And the main reason is there's a lot of different pesticides and fertilizers that'll have these metals that are in them, and they ultimately will attach to soil. So if you have a big flood, it's going to move with the soil. And then from the more urban area, these are things you would typically see like on a roadway, salts, things like that. And then a lot of people give their dogs flea treatment. And so one of the things that we see oftentimes is there's this pesticide that's in flea treatment. And a lot of times people think of pesticides and they think it's only going to be in agricultural areas where people are applying it to their crops. We actually typically see this particular type of pesticide more highly located in urban areas. It's called imidacloprid, and it did exceed the chronic macroinvertebrate, so for our bugs, levels from a chronic perspective. And so we saw it both in the ag area, and we also saw it in the urban area. And the key with that was that, I don't know, I'm a farm kid, so I grew up on a farm, and so I always feel like farms get a bad rap. But ultimately, we ended up seeing that both urban areas and the farm areas both had those really high concentrations. And we actually saw them typically higher in the more urban area.
Oh, this is really fascinating. And of course, you know, our coverage area includes all of eastern Kentucky, so we're very concerned about what you might have found there. But this is sounding like good news so far.
Yeah. So the only thing that we had in eastern Kentucky was really high levels of sulfate. And so for drinking water standards, there it's a secondary limit, meaning that it's not going to harm you physically based on the current EPA regulations, but it can make your water smell. So you, if you have that rotten egg smell and kind of that rotten egg taste, typically it's because you have high sulfate. The sulfate is going to be coming primarily from mining, where there's just a lot of movement of the soil that'll then move into your stream. The challenge with sulfate is it's extremely hard to remove from the water. So once it's in there, a lot of times drinking water treatment plants can't remove it.
Did you find significant levels of things like antibiotics, prescription drugs?
We did see background concentrations, meaning that they were low. They weren't naturally there, but they were low. And those included Tylenol, acetaminophen, and codeine. And then we did see a ton of caffeine. So caffeine typically tells us that there's a lot of straight piping. And those were the areas that we were expecting there to be a lot of straight piping. And those are the same areas we saw a lot of caffeine.
And for newcomers to our area who are not familiar with that term, what is straight piping?
So straight piping is where you have your toilet. When you flush it, there's a pipe that goes straight into the stream. It doesn't go to a wastewater treatment plant. It doesn't go to a septic system. It just literally runs downhill into the stream with no treatment. Many people drink coffee in the morning, and it does go through your body pretty quickly, and it goes into the waste, which ultimately, if you're doing straight piping, will end up in the stream.
Did any levels of these contaminants go above standards that are set to protect fish and other aquatic life, or for that matter, human life?
We did not see any that would exceed any current ecotoxicity limits of concern. One of the things we also saw was sulfamethazine, which is a type of antibiotic that people do have concerns about leading to antibiotic-resistant gene formation, so the potential for there to be kind of superbugs. So we did see that in the stream, but it, again, we've seen much, much, much higher concentrations and other locations around the country than we were seeing at these locations.
Do you think we tend to take clean, potable tap water? I mean, it's just there every day. Do we kind of take that for granted?
So the United States actually has some of the cheapest water in the entire world. And so I used to live in the western part of the country, and where water is very limited compared to what we have here in Kentucky. So in Kentucky, we are a very water-rich state is how we kind of describe it. So I do think that you can take it for granted if you've never gone during a period without water. But I would say there is enough boil alerts and other types of challenges that we have in Kentucky that I do think many people recognize the importance of drinking water and its ability to not be accessible.
Well, you haven't stopped with these findings that we've talked about and called it a day. As I understand it, you're now working on solutions. Tell us about that.
Correct. So one of the goals is we're wanting to come up with nature-based solutions. Particularly, we are interested in these type of designs. Imagine just more or less using soil, plants, and using those two things to clean your water, kind of like a filtration sponge system. And our reason for this is that it's much more cost-effective, and it can deal with extreme events. So if you have a flood or if you have a drought, these systems can usually handle that and bounce back. Smaller wastewater treatment plants, it's much more difficult when you have these changes in how much water is coming through your system. So one of the things we were looking at UK is that we were doing an experiment in our greenhouse of these miniature wetland systems, is what we call them. These are not systems you're going to be like planting to like, you know, have like for an endangered species like salamanders or something. These are purely meant to treat wastewater, so sewage. And they use them across the world, particularly in Europe and in many places in Asia. And they are mainly used for smaller communities just because they require less people to have to manage them, and they require less energy consumption. So they're cheaper overall. The biggest limitation is space, but in rural communities, typically you have more space available to deal with these type of treatment systems compared to a more urban location.
And do I understand correctly that your work is going to involve or does involve high school students?
We currently do involve high school students. We've actually been working with 13 high schools across the state. These high schools are in locations that are relatively close to the monitoring locations we were for the STREAM project. And what they do is they actually are validating what we're seeing in our greenhouse experiments and using their own water from their tap and then putting them into our wetland systems. They're kind of the size of a fishbowl, ultimately. And they do the experiments, and then we get to compare their results of what we're seeing in the greenhouses. Now, the key here is that we enrich them with certain contaminants that we were seeing in their water. For instance, in our urban areas, we were putting caffeine in there and seeing if the caffeine impacted how the wetland was performing for treatment, not for drinking water, but to release back into our streams for people to use downstream for drinking water. So that's kind of the key, is we're looking at the end point versus the start point so that we're being good water quality neighbors.
Well, after doing all this work, how do you hope this research might be used?
So our hope is that this work is going to be used to give us a baseline of what we need to be thinking about and looking regionally at how different contaminants will be in the water and kind of focusing our water treatment plans based on what we're seeing in water. The other thing that we're hoping this work will do is providing alternatives for treating wastewater or maybe even providing a secondary treatment. So once it goes through the wastewater treatment plant, maybe putting it into this type of treatment wetland to get a little more of a finishing for that water before it goes into your stream. The main reason for that is that your downstream neighbors are going to be taking that water out for drinking. So we're trying to, again, and to start where the source is versus the downstream having to deal with it.
I think there's a great Wendell Berry quote, do unto those downstream as you would have those upstream do unto you.
Exactly.
I want to run something by you. This may not be in your wheelhouse, but I've been reading about it lately, and I just wondered, since you're out there looking at water supplies, there's research published in the journal Science Advances that confirms not just that droughts and precipitation are growing more extreme, but the world's dry areas seem to be now getting drier faster, and the wet areas are getting wetter more quickly. And the research points to uninhibited pumping of groundwater by farms, cities, corporations, all of us, around the world. And so I was just wondering, in the course of doing your work, have you seen evidence of depleting groundwater in Kentucky?
Sure. So before I came to the University of Kentucky, I actually was at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and there is one of the primary places they do a lot of groundwater research, particularly because Nebraska is one of the top irrigators in the country. So we definitely were seeing at that time that irrigation was depleting the Ogallala Aquifer, which is one of the main groundwater sources for the country. And the main reason that people were reporting this, and again, I am not a groundwater expert. This is purely off of some of the things I was working with. I deal with the water quality. So mainly I would go out and take the water quality samples to make sure that the groundwater was okay for people to be using. But what they were seeing is that the pumping was exceeding the rainfall. So ultimately the aquifer, you know, if we pump too much out, you can only put so much back in. And even if you were to have rain coming, that was the exact amount of what you were pumping. Evaporation does take some of that back up into the air. So you kind of almost need more than what you're depleting coming back into your system for it to be able to stay stable. I will give a little bit of encouragement for the water depletion. I mean, there is a lot of work trying to find more drought-resistant plants, so mm-hmm. you would have to irrigate less. So there has been a lot of work with plant specialists trying to investigate different ways that we can maybe go about dealing with that. So as a little bit of hope, it's always nice to end with that. So.
It sure is. That's Dr. Tiffany Messer, Associate Professor of Biosystems Engineering at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break,
I think the prognostics for jazz are, like, extremely bright. You know, we're going to need sunglasses.
The first Equinox Jazz Festival is coming soon, and a little bit later in September, Green Room Exchange brings to Lexington the Villa-Lobos brothers performing their take on the traditional music of Veracruz.
You perform music in Veracruz as a way of establishing connections between people.
I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. And Candace Springs, one of the artists coming to Lexington for the first Equinox Jazz Festival put on by Origins Jazz at the Kentucky Theater, September 17th through the 22nd. And I'll tell you how to get all the details in just a moment. First, an opportunity to listen in on a conversation between Eastern Standard music contributor, Grammy Award-winning violinist Zach Brock, and festival organizers Chester Grundy and Richard Young.
Thank you guys so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I have so many questions and not nearly enough time, so we'll have to do a series on these, I'm sure. But I just have to give a little bit of quick background in that, of course, I grew up here in Lexington, really benefiting from the ability to hear top-level, world-class, greatest of all time jazz concerts being presented right here in the community. And it was because of you, Chester, that this was happening. And it just had a massive, massive influence on the whole trajectory of my life. And Richard, it's us knowing each other and through your work and what you're doing now with Origins here in Lexington that has enabled me to start coming back and playing concerts and getting to work with you in that capacity, and has a lot to do with me deciding to move back to Lexington. I just thank both of you so much for everything that you do for jazz and creative music and the art scene in Lexington.
That's so kind. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm really interested in getting your origin story about your early exposure to jazz music, how you fell in love with the music. Chester, could we start with you?
Sure. And thank you for that question because, you know, I had to, not too long ago, to ask myself, how did I get connected to this music? And it occurred to me that it happened when I was 8 years old. And, you know, I grew up in the 50s. I know it sounds like another dimension, but I grew up in the 1950s. And I'm you know, kid who grew up in the midst of Jim Crow segregation. But my uncle took me, when I'm 8 years old, to a concert by the Modern Jazz Quartet that was presented in Louisville by the Knights of Columbus. And it was a fundraiser. I didn't even know what the word jazz meant. But he was, you know, convinced that this was going to be a great experience for me just to be there and take this in. So I went, and we had good seats. And, you know, the context of this, I have to give a little historical context. The 1950s, for me, meant I was, when I looked for images, representations of black people on TV and in print media, all I was seeing was some of the most despicable stereotypes you can imagine. You know, Mantan Moreland, Steppin' Fetchit. I mean, the most demeaning, degrading stereotypes of black people. That's the environment I'm growing up in. So when I'm looking for representation of me, that's what I confront. That night when, and you maybe remember, the images of MJQ were, I think, unique to the music at the time, because they very intentionally were trying to address the stigma of the public perception of jazz always being associated with drugs and with alcohol and with, you know, run-down joints and all that. So these men, these four incredibly elegant men, would always come out on stage in tuxedos. And they were tall, they were elegant, they were dignified. And, you know, the short of it is, that blew me away. The image of them blew me away. And I can't say at the end of the concert that I was a jazz lover, but I sure was a lover of them. You know, and I sure was impressed with them, and I wanted to be like them. It piqued my interest. I wanted to know more about the music. But that was a hook. I mean, what they did to my psyche in terms of, like, an image of myself that I'd never been exposed to, and I liked it very much.
Wow. What about you, Richard?
Yeah, for me, the story of coming to jazz really is a result of the public school system here in Lexington. I grew up going through public schools and taking music classes. And in sixth grade, I switched to playing the bass from the violin. I was really terrible at the violin. And, you know, you don't really realize, I think at the time when you're in sixth grade or seventh grade, right, you don't really realize how important music is to you and how important the act of making music with other people is. But, like, looking back, I can see how that sort of started to shift my life. And then as I was going up through high school, I went to Lafayette here in Lexington and was mostly a classical musician. But as I started getting older, and I think maybe my junior year, I started playing a lot of jazz with friends, and then, you know, ended up joining the school's jazz band. But my first job was, like, playing in a bass saxophone duo in wine shops when I was, like, 15 and 16 and, like, bars. Like, doesn't, in retrospect, I don't know how that was legal, but that's the first way that I made money. And I then ended up going to school for music at the Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati, and, you know, went to school for classical music, but still played a lot of jazz. And for me, the joy of the art form of jazz is about making music with other people. That's true in any genre of, you know, music. You know, you're making music with others, but it is a type of spontaneity and freedom that is so hard to put into words, this, like, immediate act of co-creation. It's almost like an addictive feeling. It's very personal. It's very intimate. And to me, you know, I don't play as much as I used to, and I think that is, like, one of the biggest things that I have felt missing in my life. But the act of organizing shows, right, and bringing in artists and seeing them create something that, like, I have felt very intimately in my life, it's about as good a second as you can get.
Were you aware of the Spotlight Jazz Series when you were coming up as a youth?
No, I knew nothing about it. And when, in the very early days of starting Origins Jazz Series, myself and Eli Utelverov, who's one of the other founders of Origins, you know, when we first were talking about starting a jazz series, within the first I don't know, two conversations we had. Someone was like, oh, you need to talk to Chester Grundy. And do you know about Spotlight? And I had maybe heard a little bit about it, but I didn't really know just how truly amazing it was. And so I think the third conversation we had about Origins was with Chester. And that's when I learned about Spotlight and the incredible legacy, not just of Spotlight, but Chester's incredible legacy in this city.
Spotlight Jazz Series, I read somewhere, or maybe I heard, that it was actually the longest running collegiate jazz series in the United States.
That's true. It was more than 30 years of programming. And I'm not seeing any challenges to it, but I think we were the longest running collegiate jazz series in the country.
That's really remarkable. And that's a legacy that more people in this community, I want them to know about that. Because sometimes people seem surprised at the connection between jazz and Lexington. It's like, what are you talking about? There's a deep connection that's been going on for a long time.
Interestingly, too, a lot of the artists were surprised. You know, when you get an invitation to do a gig in Kentucky, you had a lot of people who were trying to, like, check it out before they committed to the concert. Is this real? It just didn't seem, you know, like that was, as you say, that was compatible, Kentucky and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
It was. And, I think one of the legacies of the series was that we can say, I think, to the person that every artist who came here came away really impressed with not only the quality of the infrastructure, but the audience. The audience was more hip than they thought it should be and way more appreciative. So it was a win-win for a lot of folks involved. This is like a second life for me. Okay, it's like for them to be inspired by that and, you know, to go on and build a series based on that inspiration. And then I can be involved in it. It just doesn't get better. And the beauty of it, too, is like the overlap is sometimes just knocks me out because I have people that I'm running into at our concerts who, yeah, were at concerts in 1979. And it's nothing better for me as a promoter to hear somebody share a story of an experience from 30, 40 years ago that I know only a small group of people were part of. It's better than money. You know, it's just something about that.
It says right on the Origins website that they've been inspired by the legacy of Spotlight Jazz and specifically you, Chester. And now there's something new coming up.
Yeah, we're hosting a festival. Origins is presenting it along with 250 Lex, the sort of celebration of Lexington's 250th anniversary at the Kentucky Theater in mid-September. It's called Equinox Jazz Festival. And for us, it's really an opportunity, really sort of like a culmination for us. And I think hopefully a celebration of the deep and, you know, rich legacy that jazz has in this community. It is the week leading into the equinox. And there are just so many ways that we hope that this festival can raise up the profile of jazz and its history in Lexington.
What do you see as the future of jazz music in this community in Lexington? And what are your hopes or your vision for jazz music moving into the future?
You know, I'm always amused by people, and you hear it, all jazz musicians hear it, who prognosticate about the death of jazz. You know, you hear it all the time. And it's amusing because, you know, I think people somehow believe that this is some kind of flash in the pan, that it's just some stylistic thing that's going to, like, fade away someday. Impossible. I mean, I think jazz runs so deep. It is not just music. It's a tradition. It's a worldview. You know, it's a way of seeing life. What we're hearing is just the audio expression of that, you know? So I think the prognostics for jazz are, like, extremely bright. You know, we're going to need sunglasses. And, you know, it's particularly gratifying that you see the growth in the popularity of music in places like Lexington. But there's always, you know, I was told back in 1973 when I tried to bring Yusef Lateef to University of Kentucky that there's no jazz audience. And I didn't know that there was an audience, but I knew that there were people who like high-quality music, okay? So we did that thing, and it affirmed what I knew deep down. And it's always been affirmed. I never had any concerns about the future of jazz. And particularly in times like the times we're living through right now, there's only reason for optimism in terms of like more people being drawn and becoming committed fans and devotees to this music because it is life-sustaining. You know, it represents us at our highest level of humanity. People are looking for that now. People want to affirm that now. And the music is here to stay.
Yeah, I don't think I can add much to that. The only thing I would say is, you know, I think one of the things that feels so prescient these days is that I think a lot of people feel like they can't depend on anything, right? Like you can't be sure that anything's real. You can't be sure that something's genuine or artificial. Has it been developed by an algorithm or is it something that someone actually made? And there is no question when you see live jazz that it is truly human and truly authentic. And it is something that, you know, where, you know, in our age where we can look back at posts and feeds and photos from a decade ago, the moment of seeing people co-create jazz together, that is the moment that it will happen, right? That's the moment when you are watching it, that is the only time that that's going to happen. And there is something I think so profound in the times that we're in to sit still, be present, and watch people make something together that you know you'll never be able to rewind and replay. It is your job as an audience member to really soak that in and feel it deeply.
Chester Grundy, Richard Young, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me today. And really looking forward to this Equinox Jazz series coming up.
Thank you, Zach. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
To get the details on who's performing when and for ticket information, go to originsjazz.org. And when you're finished there and still online, you might want to make your way over to greenroomexchange.org. And here's why. Green Room Exchange is bringing to Lexington another opportunity to open your ears, eyes, and mind to the cultures of the greater world. The Villa-Lobos Brothers, a Grammy Award-winning family band, have performed at Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, the Latin Grammy Awards, Montreal Jazz Festival, and the Ford Theater in Hollywood, among other venues around the world. And on September 21st, they'll bring their music to the Lexington Opera House. Violinist Luis Villa-Lobos, who, by the way, holds dual master's degrees from Berklee College of Music and the University of Freiburg, is on the line from Boston. Thanks for joining us, Luis.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me.
We're really looking forward to welcoming you to Lexington, Luis. And I understand that you're a brother band, and I know from my own experience that there's something really special about family music. How does that work for you and your brothers, Ernesto and Alberto? Have you been playing together since childhood?
Yeah, since childhood. I mean, my earliest memories, I am already holding a violin and I'm already performing with Ernesto and with Alberto, my two siblings. So it's truly, truly a family project that started in a very, very remote area of rural Veracruz in Mexico. And we were lucky enough to have the perfect combination of supporting parents and then a very, very good teacher, violin teacher, that had previous experience in the European School of Classical Music. And he was returning to Mexico to teach. So we were very, very lucky to find him and to have our parents have enough vision to support our musical journey when we were very, very young. And that, you know, after 19 or 20 years or so, that led to us being able to leave Mexico to pursue advanced degrees abroad. Ernesto, the oldest brother, he went to Manhattan School of Music in New York, and the middle brother, Alberto, he ended up going for a master's program in Brussels, in Belgium. And I am the youngest. I ended up going to Germany And later we got reunited in New York to perform BLO's Brothers, which is the project that you will hear.
Do I understand correctly that all three of you are violinists? Is that right?
That's correct. Up until we were, again, like 19 or 20 years old, you know, like our world was classical music, you know, your Beethoven's, your Paganini's, Tchaikovsky's, all of that. And we played and we learned the classical school of violin. You know, but growing up, we also were mixing that with the traditional music from Veracruz and from the lyrical musical, you know, like teachings of my grandma. She never went to school for music, but she would play the guitar and she would sing to us. So later when we finished our classical education, there was a part, I think, inside of the three of us that really wanted to reconnect with our roots, particularly with the music of Veracruz, with Mexican music. So we said, you know, why don't we try to incorporate those elements in and using the classical technique that we all developed and is so difficult to master? Why don't we mix the two of those and create something original and unique?
Tell us how Veracruz influences your sound.
Well, Veracruz is a very unique place. It's the first place where the Spanish people, you know, back in the 1400s, 1500s, is the first place where they arrived in Mexico. So it has an incredible, you know, like blend of cultures and rhythms. You know, you have the European instruments. They blended with the, you know, like native Mexican music, also with the African rhythms brought by the Spanish people. So it's very unique. If you haven't experienced, you know, stuff like son jarocho, son in general, most of the music has a different rhythmic base that we try to incorporate when we perform. It's also very improvisatory, you know, there's a lot of improvisation with the verses. But I would say perhaps the biggest way that we used to incorporate the traditions from Veracruz comes from the spirit of building community. You perform music in Veracruz as a way of establishing connections between people. It's not so much like a formal concert setting. And even though nowadays we do perform, you know, like in very, very formal concert settings and venues, we always try to make it a sort of a extended family gathering. You know, that's the spirit that we go about when we make music.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Now, Luis, I know that in 2019, you became the first musician from Latin America to be featured in a Bruce Springsteen studio recording. How did that happen?
Yeah. That was very unexpected, honestly. You know, it came about one of those things of, you know, like being at the right time and at the right place. I was invited by friends in New York. I got a call and they said, you know, like we need a violin player that can improvise, that can also read music, that they importantly mentioned, you know, like that has, you know, like legal authorization to work in the United States. And I said, yes, you know, like I am all of those things. And they said, okay, you know, we'll pick you in 30 minutes. We have a recording session. And that recording session ended up being at Bruce Springsteen's ranch in New Jersey. I initially had no idea, you know, that I would be going to that session.
Tonight the western stars are shining bright again. Sundays I take my El Camino, throw my saddle in and go.
That session in the end, you know, he didn't end up using that session for any album, but at the end of that session, I connected with his recording engineer, with Springsteen's producer, and they called me again later to do that first session that ended up being Western Stars is the album. Yeah.
All right. Well, now, I know that also you and your brothers have collaborated with Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra on the album Fandango at the Wall Live in New York City, or NYC, and it won the Best Latin Jazz Album at the Grammys in 22. Do you have another collaboration of that sort in the works, or another album, for that matter?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am about to depart right now to New York, because we will be joining forces with Arturo Farrell and his great, great orchestra. Again, we are performing at Bryant Park in New York. We also just heard probably a month ago or so that Springsteen released another recording. Probably you heard of this. It's called The Lost Tracks. a collection of several albums with, you know, music that he never released before. The Three Brothers, this time we are featuring one of his songs in that album. It's called Adelita. There is a very famous Mexican song that is, bears the same name. Adelita probably was inspired in this song. So those two are very, very exciting. And we are also, you know, like the plan is to release a new album, brand new album by the end of the year.
Well, I read on your website, Luis, that you don't believe in nations, race, socioeconomic classes or artificial boundaries that keep humanity separated, alienated even. And I just wanted to ask you briefly if you could talk to us about that philosophy and how that influences your music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think our journey, our time, you know, here on Earth, what we call life, is really all about expanding the notion of what is it that we are. I see it as that, you know, like the more we can expand the illusion of the skin, the illusion of the self, the more compassionate, the more loving, you know, like the better beings we become. So we are usually really, really concerned about a very small circle, about a very small bubble around us, you know, and that's our world, and that's the people we protect and that we care for and that we love. And I think, you know, life itself is a journey of expanding that bubble of saying, I include you, and now I include 10 more people, 100 more people. I include, you know, this entire race, this entire country. It's not like a metaphysical thing that I'm talking about here. You know, we are connected, you know, we are interdependent. Is truly, you know, like the more science advances, the more we know this to be not only a spiritual truth, but a fact. So, you know, it's only to our own demise that we can ignore this and continue behaving very, very selfishly, you know. And I think music is magic, is the closest thing to magic we have in this world, and it's a wonderful ways of trying to convey and to spread this message.
Listening to you, it takes my mind straight to Alan Toussaint's We Are All Connected, which is a great song about that very thing. Well, as I mentioned, Luis, we're really looking forward to experiencing your music on September 21st at the Lexington Opera House. Luis Villalobos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, Tom. And, you know, we are thrilled to come to Lexington and share our music with all of you.
And for more information, including tickets, go online to greenroomexchange.org. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Our thanks to Roger Chesser, host of Jazz Classics here on WEKU, for sharing the music of Candace Springs. You can find all the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. And if you want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic, just send us an email at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.